This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. As you probably know, we build this out of a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors, and this is what we got up to this week. Just listen to this, listen. I've got the fire on in the car park. That's perfectly normal, right? But last night, rural Aberdeenshire, fire on in the house. It felt like November. It was freezing. It's a cold wind coming from the north. There's still a cold wind coming from the north. I'm standing in a car park. I'm Mark Stephen, back from his travels, standing in a field. Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, it's been great. 2 weeks sailing on the west coast in brilliant sunshine, then you come back on a Saturday morning and somebody has stolen the daylight. What happened to mornings?
Gone, and never called me mother.
Yeah. Anyway, we want to know what you're up to this weekend. If you're climbing a hill, you're getting out sailing, or you're just lying in the duvet listening to this, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, tweet @BBCOutofDoors. I hope you're taking a notebook of this as you lie in your bed. There's also Facebook, and you can phone 08085 9295 00, and Sam's back in Aberdeen, ready to take your calls.
Now, obviously, we haven't been able to do Mystery Birds over the last 2 weeks because that's entirely copyrighted by Mr. Ewan McElraith, and he's all legaled up, and we didn't go anywhere near it. But this week,
yeah, we have a fantastic mystery bird. Have a wee listen to this and see if you can work it out. Yeah, I wouldn't have got that.
No, me neither.
It is a fantastic bird, and we'll give you some clues, I think, as you go on. But who knows? You may be lying in bed, so yeah, I know exactly what that is. Text 80295, tweet @BBCOutofDoors, or give us a call, 08085 9295 00.
Last week, I was talking to Richard Humpage about the Lochinvar Beg Reserve, RSPB Reserve, up in the northeast here, which is reopened to the public, which is great. A lot of reserves are open to the public. What about museums? Laura Guthrie's been to the Museum of Flight and East Fortune to find out. Plus, we're going to have not everything you ever wanted to know about moths, but quite a lot about moths this morning, and it's fascinating stuff. But first, here in Scotland, we're in the very lucky position of having the freedom to wander about the countryside and our mountains without being questioned. Nobody bats an eyelid if you are, whoever you are, male, female, in the mountains, doesn't matter.
Yeah, but that's not the case everywhere in the world. Now, Jenny Tuff, as she's known in Scotland, or Tuch, as she's known in Scotland, Tuff to the rest of the world, I've compared a number of her programmes, her talks, and she's fascinating. She's an adventurer, a filmmaker and a writer, and she set herself the task of running across a mountain range in every continent in the world, on her own and unsupported.
As well as facing the fairly obvious physical challenges, it was often the cultural sort of restrictions of a place which proved more painful for her. Here she described what she met in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco.
You know, North Africa is one of the hardest places in the world to be a woman. I don't think we should beat around the bush with that. So I did kind of run into a lot of difficult situations that brought up quite a lot of questions for myself, what it means to be a free woman, getting to travel and do these things and practice sport.
What do you mean by difficult situations? Give me some examples.
The biggest situation for me was actually I was 5 days in and I was camped. So this is at night, and if you've ever been to the interior of Morocco, the best night skies you will ever see. I was lying there in my bivvy, so I don't have a tent. I was lying there in my bivvy looking up this insanely beautiful night sky, and I'm in a really, really remote place when suddenly I hear the roar of an engine. And before I know it, two Jeeps have shown up, and I'm nowhere near a road. So how they got there, to this day, I don't know. Two Jeeps showed up, and 10 men, most of them carrying guns, pile out of the Jeeps. And then I'm lying there in my bed, looking up these 10 guys, and they're all screaming at me in a mixture of Arabic and French. And all I can really understand is they're saying, "Get in the Jeep." And I don't really know which part of my instincts came in at that point, that I just thought, well, I'm not getting in that Jeep under any circumstances. And so I actually just said, no, thanks, good night. That didn't work. we had this back and forth that these 10 guys did insist that they were part of the gendarmerie, the rural police in Morocco. None of them were wearing uniforms, so I still, you know, definitely wasn't getting in the Jeep. The Jeeps weren't marked. But anyways, they weren't going to leave me alone. I wasn't, you know, me versus 10 armed men. And in hindsight, I'm flattered they thought it would take 10 of them, but it was kind of overkill. What they were trying to say to me was that it was dangerous, that I couldn't go camping because that was just exceedingly dangerous. And what they wanted me to do instead was to come with them back to the nearest village. And I'd stayed in that village the night before, so I wasn't going back because I'd taken 55 kilometers to run out of it. And I didn't want to do it again. But also that village had been one of the most dehumanizing experiences I think I've ever had as a person, as a woman. In Morocco, women typically can't go to public places like cafes and restaurants. And when you've just run through the desert, the first thing you want to do when you get to a village is sit in the shade and have a cold drink. But I wasn't allowed. I was told no at every venue. And there was only one hotel in town. And they did allow me to stay in a room, which I'm still grateful for because I know that that was big for them. But I had to sneak in through a neighboring business door. They wouldn't let me go through the front door, or else I would disgrace the whole premises. And even just walking around the streets in this particular village was quite uncomfortable. And so I was looking at these 10 men of the gendarmerie who were telling me that here I was camping under this beautiful night sky. That was exceedingly dangerous, but I would be safer in this village that did not allow women to have freedom of movement. And I just found that really shocking. And, you know, the police force out there are, of course, 100% Arab males. They don't have any diversity, so they don't have these voices challenging them. That was the introduction to my relationship with the gendarmerie. They participated in my whole expedition after that date, actually.
How did it resolve itself?
That night, they all hiked with me. All 10 of them helped me pack my backpack. You know how, like, some jobs are best done by one person, not 10?
It's a bit like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we all packed up my backpack, and all of us hiked off into the night to the nearest Berber camp. So they knew some Berbers nearby, and they just banged on the door in the middle of the night and said, you know, this girl actually thought she was going to sleep outside. Can you believe it? She's staying with you. So a Berber house is typically two rooms. There'll be one living room / kitchen, and then there'll be the sleeping room. And the sleeping room will just be full of mattresses and blankets. And when everyone goes to bed at night, they just pull out their own stuff and lie down. But men and women who are not related cannot be in the same room. So this is the middle of the night. And I mean, even grandpa had to be kicked and woken up and put into the kitchen to sleep so that I could sleep in the bedroom. And I was just mortified by the situation. And in the morning, I actually found that I'd been locked in, that they'd locked the door from the outside to make sure that I didn't attempt to go into the wilderness again. So we didn't get off on a very good start.
Did that make you even more determined to keep going on? Because you're just trying to get away from these people.
Yeah, I mean, one was this overwhelm of these guys being around me all the time. So after that, they really did keep an eye on me, and they always knew where I was. You know, there's no hiding in Morocco. There's not like trees and stuff that you can disappear behind. It's very hard to disappear. So one was just this overwhelm. You know, I think I like running in the mountains quite a lot because I am an introvert. I really do like this quiet time. And now suddenly I'm being chased by men in a country where relationships between men and women are very complicated. So I kind of had this overwhelm of these guys, but also like I had now set myself a reputation. I dug my heels in and said I wasn't getting in the Jeep, that I'm doing this expedition, that I'm going to be successful, that women can do stuff. And, you know, I had made a whole scene about it. So there was no way I was going to fail under their watch. Like, the pressure of carrying pretty much the sisterhood across Morocco was how I felt, that I had to show these guys that it would be fine, that I had the skills, that I had the determination. Yeah, I put a lot on my shoulders to do that one.
Jenny, tough by name, Ewan.
Oh, absolutely. As I said before, I've compared probably about 10 talks with Jenny, and she is a great storyteller, but some of the adventures she's had across the world, I haven't heard your podcast, but I'm pretty sure it's fascinating stuff. But, you know, she was in South America, and she was in the village, and they said, you know, don't go to the next village, they'll kill you. Don't go to there. And she got to the next village, and they said, oh, you've been to that one? They tried to kill you. And there's so many stories about a guy galloping across in the high mountains in Nepal, you know, from 5 miles away. And she said, what's going on here? He gallops up to her and says, do you want to buy a horse?
then you wouldn't need to run. Yeah. But I mean, just an extraordinary character. Extraordinary character, you know, and she's, you can hear more about her adventures and details of a new book that she's edited called Tough Women in the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast. It's not, Tough Women's not just her stories, it's women from all around the world who've been doing really, really remarkable things. And, you know, and I said to her on the podcast, you know, just reading it, the thing it struck me was, it doesn't do that male adventurer thing of, you know, and at this stage we nearly died. You know, it's none of them are ex-military. They're not doing that sort of hip-to stuff. It's just folk getting on with it. It's really quite inspiring.
Yeah, but it does require a bit of strength of character, because I remember vividly telling me, you know, if she's in the middle of nowhere, there's no mobile phone signal, and she said, you know, if I do fall and break my leg, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. And you can't have that thought, you know, amazing strength of character, just to get away, but, you know, it'd be a great read and a fantastic listen.
Yeah, well, it is. You can find that podcast and all the others in the podcast section of the Outdoors page on the BBC Radio Scotland website and, of course, on BBC Sounds. But I was standing in the heat of the hill the other day, just looking down at the patchwork of fields, and there's some beautiful, colours on the countryside at the moment. It's just, you know, fantastic to see. Except one. There's a really skiery yellow out there. Honestly, I promise not to make a habit of this, talking about toxic plants, but this one is literally staring me in the face, and I can't ignore it any longer. It gets its Latin name, Senecio Jacobea, from its association with St. James. The Saint's Day is on the 25th of July, and this stuff is supposed to come into flower by then, which indeed this has. St. James is the patron saint of horses, which is pretty ironic, because this stuff kills horses. I'm standing in the middle of, well, to be honest, it's an infestation, several thousand plants. They're attractive enough, sort of daisy-like flowers, chrome yellow, really quite bright. The leaves are curly, but like kale, and they stand 50 to 60 centimetres tall, this lot, but they can grow up to a metre. When we moved into our small holding, the top fields were full of this stuff. It's a biennial, which means it flowers and dies in its second year after growing from seed. But each of these plants is capable of producing up to 120,000 seeds. The seeds of the plant are a wee bit like a shuttlecock. They've got these long white hairs sticking up from the seed body, and it works like a little parachute. The wind catches them and they spread from field to field. That's not good news for us, because the prevailing wind condition is from the coast, from the east, and there are some rough fields. I'm standing in one of them. And so over a period of years, we had acquired a healthy, or rather a very unhealthy, population of these plants from distant neighbours. Because we intended keeping horses, were keeping horses, we set about trying to get rid of this stuff immediately. You get these special narrow-pronged forks for loosening the roots, and then, wearing rubber gloves, you pull it up and dispose of it carefully. Year one, we lifted about 80 big black bin bags. Year two, about half of that, and the year after that, half as much again, and so on. Now, we have had our place for over 25 years, and we are still finding rosettes of this stuff coming up. And we still make a point of going to look for it, because we make our own haylage, or hay, and you really don't want this plant to be in amongst either. My old farming neighbour, Doug Simpson, Dougal Doug, gone these years past now, used to insist on calling this stuff tansy, and eventually I just gave up trying to convince him otherwise. Tansy is a completely different plant, Tanacetum vulgare. The French used to make omelettes with tansy. Folk used to make tansy cakes at Easter. Just out of curiosity once, I nibbled a bit of tansy and I found the taste unbearably strong, which may explain why our forebears also used tansy to keep mice from corn and flies off meat. This plant is not tansy. This is common ragwort, and nobody in their right minds would cook with any part of it. The old Scots name for ragwort is Stinking Billy, supposedly a dig at William, Duke of Cumberland, who celebrated his victory at the Battle of Culloden by spending the next few years metaphorically machine-gunning the lifeboats. Butcher Cumberland was hated in the Highlands, hence the nickname. And the fact is, the plant that bears his name does smell. It's a sour, slightly bitter odour, almost acrid. And that's because it contains several alkaloid poisons which destroy the liver. It causes a form of cirrhosis. Once it gets to a certain stage, it's irreversible. And the alarming thing is nobody's too sure what constitutes a lethal dose. It's got a cumulative effect and there's no known antidote or cure. It can be absorbed in small quantities through the skin, which is why I said earlier, if you're picking this stuff out of the ground, wear rubber gloves. Now, there's horses right now in amongst this ragwort, and they won't touch it while it's alive and green and standing. But if the plant dies, it seems to lose its highly bitter taste, and then they're quite happy to eat it. It might not be bitter anymore, but it still contains those toxic alkaloids, which is why if you pull it up, you have to get rid of it carefully. Either burn it or take it to your local cowp. I check with my local skip in Inverurie. They will take ragwort, but you have to put it in the general waste skip and not the garden one. If you get into a conversation about ragwort, frequently people say things like, oh yes, it's a notifiable weed. I'm not sure what that means, and to be honest, I'm not sure such a thing even exists. There is legislation called the Weeds Act 1959, which was aimed at protecting commercial food production. It covers five weeds, two docks, two thistles, and ragwort. In theory, here in Scotland, Scottish ministers have the power to use measures of enforcement to prevent the spread of weeds on private land, but to be honest, I don't know if it's ever happened. There's also something called the Ragwort Control Act of 2003, but why they even bothered passing that is a mystery to me, as it's basically just a code of conduct and imposes zero responsibilities on landowners to do anything about it. So in short, ragwort is chancy stuff, but everything on this earth must have some sort of redeeming feature, some sort of purpose if you looked hard enough. Something must love ragwort, and that something turns out to be the caterpillars of cinnabar moth. These very handsome black and yellow tiger stripe jobs. Ragwort is their favourite foodstuff. They love it. Now, I've driven past fields of this stuff with friends and family, you know, and it is pretty in the sunshine, don't get me wrong. They've looked at it and they said how bonny it was, and me, I just see threat. It worries me. So call it what you like, stinking billies, Sinachia jacobaea, common ragwort. This stuff and livestock, horses particularly, should not mix. Ever. A cautionary tale of ragwort there. And I mentioned the cinnabar moth. We've got a lot more about moths coming up after the news.
Get out today and pull up some ragwort and make the world a safer place. Yeah. But back to the mystery bird. Slightly different sound this time. There's a bit of a Sid James vibe going on here. See if you can guess what this is.
That's not Sid James, that's Kenneth Williams.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's your favourite carry-on character?
Yeah,
call us now. I don't know if it'd be a clue or not. You can see them all round our coasts. Very dramatic. You will not mistake this bird. Well, actually, more on this later, but big bird, dramatic bird, mm-hmm. all round their coast. If you've got any idea what that is, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, tweet @bbcoutofdoors, or give Sam a ring. Make his morning, 08 085 92 95 00, because I think he's been quite quiet so far.
Well, Paul from Hamilton says, is the mystery bird a puffin? No, good guess though. And Moira Tui Broughty Ferry says, it's definitely Donald Duck talking to Ewan in code.
And I can see where she's coming from there.
Yep. As coronavirus restrictions ease slightly, though, more places are going to be able to open their doors to visitors. One such place is the National Museum of Flight in East Lothian, where Laura Guthrie went to speak to Steve McLean, general manager of the museum.
We're in the middle of East Lothian, the back of beyond in the countryside. But actually, we're not far from the A1. We're only about 3 or 4 miles off the A1 between Haddington and North Berwick. So it really is 3 or 4 minutes from the A1 and you're here. So it's pretty good access.
And it's a glorious day of sunshine today.
It's I like to tell everybody it's always like this. I'm lying completely. But it is absolutely lovely today. Beautiful, beautiful weather and it's lovely scenery. So yeah, great day.
And you'll be particularly pleased because you've obviously just been able to reopen the museum, which must have been great news.
Well, I'm particularly pleased because I've been here for 4 months almost on my own with a few other staff, and it's been very strange. So it was great when we first let visitors back in a couple of weeks ago. Lovely to see people enjoying themselves. And we put a lot of efforts into making the site nice and safe for everybody, and everybody seems to be appreciating that. So it's all running really, really smoothly. Touch wood. So, really happy people are back and seem to be having fun.
And I suppose, compared to quite a lot of museums, you've definitely got size and scale to your advantage.
We do. I mean, that's one of the advantages of the site, because we sit on an historic airfield, East Fortune Airfield, which originated in the First World War and then subsequently was used by the RAF in the Second World War. We sit on a part of the Second World War site. And as you can imagine, as you quite rightly say, there's a lot of spaces. In fact, the operators that used to work here during the war remember having to walk miles and miles between the different hangars. So it is a bit like that. There are four big hangars and quite a lot of ancillary buildings where our collections are displayed. There's lots of indoor space, but you can walk between the spaces to get to each exhibit. And when it's a lovely day like this, that's just a pleasure.
It is, definitely. I think I'm going to burn standing out here. But when I was coming in, I drove past, I noticed one thing in particular was the Vulcan. It's quite an iconic kind of plane.
It is, yes. I mean, we've got quite a lot of aircraft here that are quite iconic. Concorde, not least of which is Concorde, of course. The Vulcan is a favourite of many people, one of mine as well. I remember as a boy I used to go to Lookers and watch the Vulcan, and he used to always turn his engines towards the crowd and throttle up, and it was a really, really noisy aircraft. Our Vulcan is one that took place in the hostilities in the Falkland conflict, and it landed in Argentina when it broke down. So it's got a really, really interesting history, and like all our aircraft, is irreplaceable, and definitely one of the favourites on site.
And it's one of the ones that's out in the open air.
It is, yes. We've got three aircraft out in the open: the Vulcan, we've got a Comet, and we've got the BAC-111 just over the road there. The rest of the aircraft are all indoors.
And Concorde, of course, that must be the one that a lot of people come to see.
Everybody comes to see Concorde. I mean, I think it never ceases to amaze me that the minute people step through the door into the Concorde hangar, the first thing they say is wow. It's almost to a person, everybody goes wow. And it really is a wow moment. You see the nose kind of hanging in space, and then you turn the corner and there's the full glory of the aircraft staring you in the face. It is a fantastic aircraft. It was a Concorde moment, as they say, you know, designing and flying that aircraft, and everybody is obviously sad that it's gone, you know. But however, it's here forever, hopefully, and people can still enjoy it.
And what you mentioned, that you were here kind of during lockdown, that must have been a bit surreal having the run of the place.
Yeah, well, there was four of us on site. We sort of took turns on shifts, and then we have security overnight as well. So there had to be somebody here all the time to look after the site, and it was just keeping up with the maintenance and so on, things that you don't think about, that things are going to start leaking if you don't keep on top of it, you know. So it was just looking after the buildings, looking after the collections. Our collections team would come and look after the aircraft, pump up tires, things like that, just all these regular little maintenance jobs that need to be done. But of course, a lot of our time over the 4 months we were closed was planning for reopening and putting in place all the safety measures that we put in place. And as I say, people have reported back that one of the things they like about coming here is that they feel safe when they're here, which is great. You know, as we worked hard to achieve that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, you've got size and scale to your advantage.
Yeah, exactly. It all was. And we were the first museum out of our family, National Museum Scotland, to open. Rural Life over in East Kilbride opened a week later, and then our main museum in Chambers Street in Edinburgh just opened yesterday. So that was a big moment for us as well. So that's three out of our four museums, the War Museum, still to open. So we're nearly there. So we're definitely getting there.
I suppose the maintenance of things is probably, like you say, something people don't think about. They probably think that the planes come here, they're parked up, and that's it. But I'm guessing that there's a lot more to it.
There's a lot to do. Not just the actual, because the buildings themselves date back to the Second World War. So looking after those buildings is a full-time job in their own right. The actual fabric of the buildings themselves, as well as the infrastructure around the site, drainage has to be kept cleared, so otherwise hangars flood. You know, they've always got to be jetted 2-3 times a year. And then the aircraft themselves, there's cleaning, dusting, there's tire pumping, there's all sorts of things to be done, and any repairs that need to take place as well. It's a never-ending job, but we wouldn't do it if we didn't love it. So we do love it.
And apart from Concorde, which I think we've kind of established as a firm favourite, for people who are coming here maybe in the next few weeks, what would your top thing to visit here, what would it be?
You know, it's a really, really interesting question. I mean, for me, my favourite aircraft is the English Electric Lightning, which is in Hangar 2. To me, it's a really iconic aircraft. It was the first RAF jet to reach Mach 2, twice the speed of sound. It was about the only interceptor that could catch Concorde, actually, funnily enough. Except they did it. Concorde did it with a cup of coffee, and these guys in the lightnings did it with these kind of spacesuits on, you know. So, but it was I remember it as a child going to the Lucas Air Show and watching the lightnings and the Vulcans flying around, you know. So it was that kind of Cold War era I'm really interested in. So to me, that's one of the best. But there are. My favourite is not everybody's. There's the Harrier, there's the Spitfire, there's all our civil aircraft as well. Some of which have got amazing stories. One that was built in somebody's house, So they've all got amazing stories to tell, and that's something that we pull out in the displays. It's not just about. We talk about the technology, of course, and the design and innovation, but also it's the people behind them and the stories that come with them, and that's the bit that is really, really interesting. So we pull all that out in the displays as well, and I think people really enjoy that.
Steve McLean there from the National Museum of Flight, speaking to Laura Guthrie there. And you do have to book tickets to visit the museum. There are a few other guidelines to keep in mind, so visit their website. There is a link on ours to plan your trip. You know, the fact is, Ewan, if you were to build Concorde today and put it on the runway, it would look futuristic. What a fabulous aircraft that was.
It's just, it was one of my great regrets in life, never actually managing to take the flight across to the States. It must have been someone else. But I do admire Laura for going to the airfield, especially when you've got the copyright on all things aviation.
Yes, obviously she's fired as of this stage, and I wish her well on her next employment, but you know, nobody touches aircraft except me. Them's the rules.
Yeah. I was looking at a biplane as I was sailing on the wheel. But tell you, it was a fantastic moment. I'm sailing up the Sound of Mull.
Uh-huh.
And first of all, there's a Hercules comes at, my mast must have scraped his bottom as he went over. And that was fantastic. And honestly, you've been there, the wee airfield as you go up the Sound of Mull.
Yeah.
There was a biplane came low along the Sound of Mull and went and landed at the wee airstrip there and then took off again. How good would that be?
Yeah, no, I do. Oh, yeah, it'd be fantastic. Absolutely lovely. Hey, listen, here's an email we got in from a lady called Rachel, and this is really quite extraordinary. It says, I wanted to say hello from Bristol and say how much I love your show. I lived in Scotland for 6 years and go back every year as often as I can, but life has taken me away from Scotland to live now. My daughter Isabel was born a couple of weeks ago, and I was listening to podcasts of previous shows whilst on the delivery suite before she was born. I have a vivid memory of listening to Helen's piece on wild swimming at 1 a.m. and it taking me away from the clinical room I was in and the fear of what was to come and into a much needed moment of calm, imagining myself back in Scotland and in a Scottish loch. That is a memory I will treasure forever. She goes on to say, Isabel was born many hours later by emergency cesarean in the end. The radio was on in the theatre, tuned to BBC Radio 2, Surgeon's Choice. But fittingly, Caledonia was playing at the moment she was born. Now we will be listening in the quiet of the early morning breastfeeding sessions and would love a hello. Thank you for your show. It is wonderful. Well, big hello to Rachel and baby Isabel. Congratulations.
Yeah, who knows, out of door is available in the National Health Service. We're taking the world by storm now.
Yeah, I don't know if it's actually got pain-killing effects. I suspect not, truth to be told. But it's, as long as we're being of some use to somebody, I suppose that's the important thing.
Takes your mind to somewhere else, that's what we do.
Yeah, well, you never know. You just don't know what you're going to do when you get up in the mornings. Coming up, the 90th anniversary of the evacuation of St Kilda. And, of course, the answer to this week's mystery bird. Plus, Ewan meets Aberdeenshire farmers Michelle and Robert.
And then we got this message from Instagram, and it was like, for this video for Jay-Z, we were like, what? Mm. But you see a big name like that, Jay-Z, and you just sort of think to yourself, no way,
Can't be.
It just can't be.
Michelle Sullivan and husband Robert there, who might have 99 problems, but this week publicity ain't one of them. Bet you never thought you'd hear a Jay-Z reference on Out of Doors.
And you may never hear it again. It's an absolutely fascinating story, all coming up soon. But, the mystery bird's beginning to take off. But have a wee listen to this and see if you've any idea which bird this is. Well, has that helped? I guess probably not. You've got some suggestions already.
Yep, Barry Sutherland, South of Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, has been in touch to say, is it a puffin in its tunnel? And then says, did Ewan listen to the show while he was away? I heard you mention moths, and I'm wondering if anyone's seen the cinnabar moth. I've seen a few, but I'm wondering how far north they migrate. They tend to appear with groundsel, which is the same family as ragwort. Didn't know that. Do you know if groundsel grows as prolific as ragwort? The cinnabar caterpillar also is the same colour as a wasp. Thank you. That bit I did know. I don't know if groundsel grows as prolific as ragwort. I suspect not, Barry Sutherland. Paul Linnard says, is the mystery bird a grouse, red or black? I think I'll go with red.
Well, I can see where they're coming from there, yeah, though. There's a bit of that kind of go back.
Yeah, capercaillie type thing. Colin and Mary Abercrombie says, I'll have a go at the mystery bird and say it's a gannet. Keith Sutherland thinks it's a gannet too in Blairgowrie. Well, not the gannet in Blairgowrie, he's in Blairgowrie. And Jenny Nethybridge says, it's a skua.
Oh, they're getting closer.
Creeping up on it.
Yeah, certainly don't think grouse, go think the other two, because they kind of all happen, live in the same sort of territory.
Yeah. Oh, well. Now, back when we were in full lockdown, I decided in a moment of madness to make a moth trap. It was a bit early in the year, and I'll be honest, it wasn't entirely an unalloyed success, but at the time we chatted live to Dr. Mark Young, Emeritus Senior Lecturer in Biological Sciences at Aberdeen University, and, to put it mildly, a moth enthusiast. Mark is fabulous on the subject of moths. He lives not terribly far away from where I stay, so last week I took the chance to go around and just see what he was up to.
Here's my moth trap, and you can see it's got heaps of moths inside it. And to keep it ready for you to look at, I've done something rather odd. It's got four little holes that lead down into the trap, and I've stuffed some old socks in there to stop the moths from flying
out. I did think that was unusual.
Well, it's a classic thing to do. It's what people do. So it's like a lobster pot. It's got the light source at the top, which is high in ultraviolet light, which attracts insects. It's got a cone with a hole at the bottom. The moths go down through that hole. And then the rest of the trap is quite a big, large sort of plastic tub with a perspex top to it. And the moths, when they come to try and escape, they fly up to the perspex where there's light. They can't get out, obviously. And inside there are egg cartons, and they provide beautiful conditions for the moths to settle on. So here they are, most of the moths are settled, they're on the egg cartons, and when we open the trap, one or two will fly away. We can't catch everything, but many of them will be on those egg cartons.
When I built my moth trap, which was a Heath Robinson contraption, I can't remember how many ago, I think a dozen was the best I ever managed to achieve. We haven't lifted the lid off this yet. It is hoaching. It's absolutely, I don't know how many you've got, dozens and dozens and dozens.
Absolutely so. It's just the best time of year for large numbers of moths, middle July to middle of August-ish. And also, last night was brilliant. It was mild, it was still, it was humid, Perfect for moths. Okay. So I've got a huge catch. And I try and write everything down so that I can record them for the National Recording Scheme. And that means that somehow or other, we have to get the moths out of here with me able to write down what I've got and you able to see what's there.
Yeah, well, no problem then.
You can see these fairly thick-bodied, big things down in here. You'll see in a moment or two, many of them are what's called the large yellow underwing. It's an abundant species. We call them noctuids. They're the big, thick-bodied moths. Then you have some which have got long, thin bodies and broad, spread-out wings, and they're called geometers. And the reason for that is the caterpillars have got legs at the front and the back, and they loop their way along when they're walking, and it looks as if they're measuring the earth, which is why they're called geometers.
Okay? Right, okay.
But then I'm also interested in what we call micromoths. It's a much smaller thing. It, generally speaking, is neglected by people who open moth traps, but I love them. So how are we going to play this? Because when we open that, moths will begin to fly.
Go for the big reveal. Let's see what happens.
Right, well, what I'm going to do, I've got a little round net. Uh-huh. I'll open this, put that net on to keep the others inside, but we'll have a look and see what we've got.
Okay.
Wow, now look, you said you'd only caught a dozen moths previously. This is the underside of the lid, and I've got more than that just on the underside of the lid.
You're just showing off right here. Yeah.
This is one of these noctuids. This is the lesser broad-bordered yellow underwing. And if I disturb it, you will see the flash of yellowy orange from the hind wings.
Ah, yeah.
and it's thought to first of all startle a bird if a bird catches it, but then when it flies, you see the flash of orange like that, I've just let it go, you look at it, you follow it, it settles and it puts away that orange, and you're looking for something orange, and all you can't see it because it's yeah. And here are these geometers. Look, this one is called the July High Flyer.
They've got fantastic names.
They do. They're amazing, and they're about 200 or 300 years old. Some of these names, and that's the common marble carpet. But just utterly confusingly, this great big one here, which actually does have an English name, even though it's a micro, is called the Mother of Pearl. It's a micro for no reason at all. It's people have decided that family of moths are micros. So, I must make sure I write all these names down.
Okay.
I do this in the summer months when it's nice weather. I mean, nice for moths. I do it fairly regularly. But I, generally speaking, don't do it every night because I want the moths to have a chance to go off and fly off and mate and lay eggs and things. Let's take out one of these trays.
That's not a moth, but what is that? That's an extra...
There are two burying beetles. Okay. They're attracted by the light, so they're necrophorous. They're looking for a corpse. Uh-huh. They found the light instead. Oh, they're horrid things for two or three reasons for me, for a moth trap. First of all, they smell disgusting. Uh-huh. Secondly, they scrabble around in the trap and their legs scratch the moths, or they almost eat them. So they disturb everything. And they eat holes into the egg boxes.
Basically, the black and orange banded.
Yes, it is.
I have no recall of seeing those before at all.
Oh, really? Oh, well, they're very common. Yeah. If you were to find a corpse out, say a dead rabbit, and there was a dead rabbit, a rabbit had died and it was lying out in the countryside, go back the following day, turn it over, and you'll probably find those underneath, because they look for corpses, and they dig a hole under the corpse, allow the corpse to sort of settle into the ground, and lay their eggs on it. Okay. So they're burying beetles. Yeah. Very common.
The supremely knowledgeable Dr. Mark Young there, and more from him coming up shortly. Have you ever seen one of those burying beetles, just black and yellow jobs?
Yeah, they're quite common. You'll see things lying dead, dead birds and things like that, uh-huh. Suddenly disappear. They're slightly macabre, but they serve an absolutely vital part of the ecosystem, otherwise there'd be corpses lying around all over the place.
Yeah, I suppose. I was really surprised. It's very common, I thought. I have genuinely, at my age, I've never seen one of my puff before.
Not looking under dead rabbits. we'll go around looking for ragworts, start looking for beetles.
Yeah, well, that's where the excitement obviously is. Today, as I was saying, marks the 90th anniversary of the evacuation of St Kilda. Now, we recently repeated the programme we made on our trip there back in 2011. Since then, the last surviving St Kildans have died and changes have been made to the Ministry of Defence buildings in the islands too. To tell us about what St Kilda's like now and more about the original evacuation is Alistair McKechin, Rebecca resident and member of the St Kilda Club. He joins us on the line. Good morning, Alistair. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
Good. Alistair, 90 years ago to this day, what would the islanders actually have been doing at this time?
Well, just at this particular time, they would have been on board the boat, the HMS Harebell, that was taking them away from the island. They left on the morning of the 29th August at 6 a.m. And they would probably about this time be just losing sight of their island, making for the mainland, for the Sound of Mull, I think, just where Ewan had been sailing not so long ago.
Yeah, well, it was bizarre, Alistair, because I was actually in Loch Allen. I tied up at the end of the loch, but at the pier at Loch Allen is where they came ashore, and I met a gentleman whose mother vividly remembers the islanders coming ashore, and all the folk in the town came down to greet them and offer them hospitality, and a bit of a rugby scrum from the press. I would love to go back to St Kilda, but obviously we can't at the moment. But has it changed a lot?
Yes, just kind of picking up on your repeat of your recording, the previous year's trip to St Kilda, two of the things I think kind of highlighted on was, yes, we unfortunately have no living St Kildans now. In that decade, the last of the St Kildans have passed on. Another point that was raised was just the impact of the more modern buildings, the MOD establishment on the island, and that is often remarked on when people see St Kilda for the first time. So in that time, there certainly have been, you know, significant developments on the island in terms of modern buildings, in that the base at that village area has actually been redeveloped and rebuilt, and the objective being to reduce the impact of modern buildings on the historic settlement. So they have achieved that by reducing the footprint in the first place, and the type of building is kind of more in keeping with the surroundings. And the other important part was that the buildings, actually the kind of modular style, if you like, is reversible, so that if circumstances change or not so many buildings are required, you know, they can be dismantled and taken away. So I think that's actually a big achievement over the last while, and a big investment by the MOD in their estate on the island.
The MOD buildings were basically just boxes, you know, strapped down, because it can get pretty wild on St Kilda. They weren't bonny, they were painted dark green, etc. But I remember talking to the cook there, and he says, you know, folk don't like these. He says, no, I think it's really unfair. He says, because we're history too. And I thought, you know, that's actually a perfectly valid point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. It's, I mean, it goes back, you know, to the mid-50s.
Yeah.
So, obviously, a part, you know, an important part of Cold War history. I think the type of buildings in the terms of design was pretty typical of late 60s, early 70s. I mean, that was not the initial army, if you like, establishment on the island. If when they landed there in 1957, they proceeded to build Nithin huts and wooden huts, and there was a redevelopment program then in the late 60s, early 70s. And these buildings, I suppose, as you described them, square, box type, flat roofed, were fairly typical of buildings of that kind of era. And then when you say they were tied down, yes, they were tied down following our 2005 hurricane. Winds reached close to 200 miles an hour on St Kilda.
Wow.
And the downdrafts and the eddying of the wind actually raised these flat roofs, just basically creating a vacuum above the roof.
Yeah.
And so the corners you would have seen at that time probably had to be anchored down.
Yes.
It was like
ratchet straps holding the whole thing down, basically. But coming back to the original islanders, you know, obviously 90 years ago today, as you say, at this stage, they would be sailing away from the island, losing sight of the island. This is an archive clip of one of them, a gentleman called Neil Ferguson Sr.
Fine, I mind the evacuation of St Kilda. I was the last to leave the island. All the rest were on board the steamer early in the morning. I was in charge of the post office and made every excuse to remain as long as I could. I was threatened and pleaded with, but I always made the excuse that I wasn't ready yet. But excuses were of no use. I went for a last walk round the village. It was weird passing the empty houses. It was just like looking at an open grave.
That's a very telling phrase. That so for instance, he worked in the post office, which, I mean, and the post office is a really important part of the island.
Yes, communication in itself, you know, was for them getting communication of any kind to the mainland or to the adjacent islands was a bit of an issue. Then a post office was established. Late 1900 or so before it got kind of up and running, and then subsequently there were issues with GPO and the cost of getting mail and who would do it and various fishing companies and trawlers and such involved. But also another aspect of the post office and the mail was the tourist industry at that time. I mean, there were summertime tourists going to the island on the Dinara Castle and the Hebrides, and of course the thing to do was send a postcard from St Kilda with the St Kilda postmark, and that went on right up to the very last day. In fact, it was the 28th of August that the mail was taken off the island, and they had a huge demand for postcards, self they were getting self-addressed envelopes coming to actually get the final postmark from St Kilda itself.
Have you got any of the postcards?
And you've actually got a postcard from Neil.
Oh, right.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I've been known some of the St Kildans, been given some stuff for safekeeping that will hopefully go into. We're planning various things on the islands here to do with archiving material. And the actual postcard that Neil, that was just interviewed there, Neil Senior sent to his son, who at that time was living in Glasgow with his brother. His brother had set up a shop in Glasgow. But anyway, Neil sent Donald John a postcard on the middle of June, 1930, with the actual message, probably the breaking news that Tom Johnston, the Under Secretary of State, had just visited the island on the fishery cruiser Mina, and he says, definitely we'll be away in 6 weeks. The Dinara has not been yet. So that is actually the news going out to us in Kildon on the mainland, that basically the evacuation plan is on for 6 weeks' time. So it's there with a wonderful St Kilda clear postmark.
Backstory. Alistair, we could say, and I would like to, I would love to be on St Kilda with you and actually just go through this in complete detail. But thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All the best.
Alistair McEachin there. Fascinating insight into just that wee snapshot in time.
I think you're right. I could listen to that for hours. It'd be really nice to go back when all this horribleness is over and just go back, because there was so many stories we didn't even have time to put in two programmes or three programmes. Yeah. Fascinating stuff.
Well, not only is it 90 years since the St Kildan community was evacuated, it's 180 years since the last great auk in the UK, or gairfowl, as they were called in St Kilda, was killed there. Mm-hmm. Musician Ewan MacDonald and his father Murdo are relatives of one of the men who killed the great auk, Lachlan McKinnon, and together they conceived a project called Gairfowl, an exploration of the music of St Kilda. Ewan joined Bruce McGregor on Travelling Folk this week to explore the album and Ewan's family connection to St Kilda. Fascinating listen. You can catch the music and the interview on BBC Sounds Now. Earlier this week, you might have seen it was clearly odd, story of an Aberdeenshire farming couple who have played a part in a Pharrell Williams and Jay-Z music video.
Yeah, Michelle and Robert Sullivan found themselves at the centre of a bit of a media scrum, but the story of how they got into farming I find just as interesting, if not more so, than about how the video came about. Now, I went to find out how a couple, both with six-figure salary jobs in London, ended up making a new life for their family near Inch in Aberdeenshire.
Farming wasn't, anywhere...
It wasn't on the cards.
No.
And to be honest, because we sort of started to take our faith a lot more seriously then, there was a book that I'd actually read at the time. It was called Country Living by an author by the name of Ellen G. White. And I read that book. It's actually quite a small book. You could sit literally and read it in an hour. And it was very inspiring. It spoke about the benefits of living in a rural environment and the benefits that it has upon children. Yeah. And
we had a growing family at the time, family.
That's right. And we were actually homeschooling at the time as well. Mm. So I, looking at that, it just built a picture in my mind of, wow, this sort of rural life and, the kids kick off their shoes and just run around on the grass and just be free like lambs, And I loved the idea of that.
Yeah. And that was completely alien to us. I mean, not to say that, there's nowhere green in city environments. Of course there is. But,
we had a garden at the time. You could barely swing a cat in.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
Admire and understand the aspiration.
Yeah.
But making that work,
how
do you suddenly say, I'm going to be a farmer? Because it's not as simple as that.
Well, that was the next step, really, because it's one thing moving, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then when you get there... Okay, now what? Now what do we do?
Yeah.
And that now what lasted a little while. At the time, actually, when we moved, Robert was finishing his law degree. And then we realised that, actually, his English law degree wasn't going to work in Scotland. So we were like, ouch.
Oh, dear.
So that sort of knocked that on the head.
So it was like, okay. And obviously, being a faith, we just started praying. And we were like, what would you have us to do?
We need some ideas here.
So I went, actually, funnily enough, went back to that same little book, Country Living. And it spoke so much about... you know, supporting yourself through agriculture. And the whole idea of that was just like, wow. So we started researching it. And so with that, you found some folks like Elliot Coleman. I don't know if people have heard of Elliot Coleman.
Yeah, he's written a number of books on small-scale farming. So not necessarily hundreds of acres, but just an acre or two and being able to use methods and farm efficiently so that those couple of acres could produce as if you were using
hundreds
of acres.
That's
so,
right.
So how much land have you got?
So the property that we're staying at now is actually on 3 acres, but we only farm just under 1 acre of that. And we've learned about how you can actually turn over beds and
very quickly,
and you can actually grow quick growing crops. So you can get like 4 times the amount out of one bed. So that way you kind of multiply your income.
Yeah. So what you do, there's what's called succession growing. And when we're speaking about this, all of this was completely new to us because, as I said, prior to, you know, even putting our hands in the soil, I sort of had like an aversion to mud. I just didn't like, you know, it just wasn't my thing. I didn't even have a pair of welly boots, you know, because I wouldn't walk in mud. So the idea of getting in the soil just wasn't my cup of tea. But having said that, back to your question. Yeah, so successions means that, you know, each week, normally you sort of run a 7-day cycle. You could then, depending on your beds. So we use beds that are 30 inches wide and 100 foot in length. So, for example, with the radishes, so we would put one bed of radishes, which will take about 28, 30 days to come up. But the next week we will plant another set of radishes, and then the next week and so on and so on.
Just strikes me as a really steep learning curve.
Definitely.
Yeah.
How important was your faith at that time? Because I would imagine saying, this is scaring me.
Yeah. And many times, so it was a faith move, because you have to understand that for us, because we've had no prior experience in this, it's fine reading books and it's fine doing research, watching YouTube videos and this, that, the other. But when you actually get out there,
at some point, the rubber has to hit the road.
Yeah. And then you learn by your mistakes.
So
there were many, many, many failures.
And we're still making mistakes, you know, we're still learning, you know. We're 4 years now into sort of growing, you know, for retail or for commercial. And, you know, that's farming for you. You're always going to be learning. This doesn't work, that doesn't work. This is great, that is great, you know, and that's just how it goes.
Yeah. What about the markets? Because you're producing really classy looking vegetables. You're doing edible flowers, you're doing micro salads, micro...
Microgreens.
Where's your market for all of that?
Yeah, so prior to COVID, I'll answer in two ways. Our main market was the restaurants and hotels. That was the main trade.
The
chefs. But since COVID, everything's changed. So all of our customers, about 99% are retail customers. And we've moved from doing a lot of the microgreens and the edible flowers and things like that to more of the veg boxes. So it's changed a bit, but at the moment it seems to be going back, because obviously with some of the restrictions being lifted with COVID, we're getting a lot more
restaurants coming back
inquiries.
And you have to adapt with it. You really do. You
know,
we were actually just ready when you know, the lockdown happened. We were ready to just, in fact, I think we powered off the lights for the microgreen room. And we were like, okay, we'll sit tight. Actually, we can have a holiday, because no longer do you have to keep running around doing all these deliveries. So we were thinking, oh, we're going to get some space
this
to ourselves.
Be good. Yeah.
And then we got a whole stream then of orders that came through for the veg boxes. So we were like, okay.
Oh. We're still
no
going to be busy.
Us.
It's a whole new market.
Yeah.
Has it worked out? You look really happy together.
Yeah.
We are.
But it's an ongoing process.
But this was all part of it, you know? When we decided to move out to a country location and decide to farm, it was actually a family-motivated choice.
Yeah.
And once again, it's because, you know, we believe that, you know, that's what God wants for us. He wants families to be together. He wants them to nurture their relationships. And it's very difficult to do that. It's not impossible, of course. You have to be very...
disciplined.
When you're living in a city environment and everything is so fast-paced, you know, and you're coming in and out of London, et cetera, you know, and you rarely have time for each other. And we know because...
We've
lived in the city and we have raised children in the city, but our lives are completely different now. Obviously, with our younger children, we're always here, you know.
Yeah.
My husband's always here. I'm always here. We can farm together. The children, as I said, they throw their shoes off. They come in the farm. They help us. They pick flowers. And it's a completely different lifestyle. And we definitely prefer this, you know.
Yeah.
Why is farming such a predominantly white occupation?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. And the irony about that question is that this is just our own observation. From a lot of the families that have come over, let's say from the African continent, and even some parts of India, and even a little bit of the West Indies, a lot of the families have been involved in agriculture.
In their home countries.
In their home countries.
But when they come here, they
But they've left there.
Yeah. They want to get away from that.
Yes.
Yeah, to seek the better life.
Yeah, and to get that academic job and earn a larger money. But I think, you know, we left a six-figure income and, you know, you can still make a six-figure income from the farm. And I just think people just don't realise that. And I think they associate being in poverty, say, back in a home country. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm. So they've linked the two together. Farming
so
equals poverty.
Want to be a doctor, a surgeon, farming is poverty.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, that. Who knows? You know.
Or could it perhaps be a lack of awareness? I mean, yeah.
As well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, as well.
If people knew.
Nobody told me I could be a rocket scientist when I was at school.
No, didn't.
Did you get the farming option?
No, we
didn't know anything about that.
And I think that's kind of how it is in schools these days, isn't it? It's always a push towards academics.
Yeah,
you know,
and what that could give you.
Yeah,
as in a better life. And that's there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But it's what is the better life? What's the definition of a better life? Is the definition more money equals better life? I don't think so necessarily.
Well, it's nail on the head. Yeah. You've got a better life now than you had before.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I would say so. It's like we always would joke and say, you know, before we had everything, but we had nothing. Mm. And now it may seem like we have nothing, but actually we have everything.
Yeah. No, seriously.
Michelle and Robert Sullivan there. Interesting folk.
Oh, just fascinating. Mark, you know, when you meet a couple who are so happy together and so happy with the decision they've made, it just kind of, it fills the room. You kind of, I came away with a huge smile, kind of really inspirational. To leave those big jobs behind and jump into the world of farming was a big jump. But a lot of farmers are coming round to have a look. You know, they're surrounded by farms of 100, 200 acres, but they're making a good living on 1 acre. Incredible. Yeah.
That is very, very good. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where you listen to the podcast. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Leif Gustafsson from Sweden did. He says, good morning from Sweden. I have to thank you for your programme. I found your podcast this winter and I've listened to them all. We've been to Scotland twice for a week each time and it will be the first place we travel to after COVID-19.
He goes on to say the programme, and this is hard to believe actually, is also perfect to listen to learn better English.
Really?
I listen from Orebo, in the middle of, between Stockholm and Gothenburg, and it's also a lovely place. It is, absolutely. Best regards, Leif.
Coming up, a walking group which is heading back to the outdoors, and we will reveal, eventually, what is making this noise.
Okay, still time to guess. Get in touch. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 and give Sam a call. 0808 592 95 00. I'll give you a clue, the 8 fish.
They're getting closer. Definitely getting closer. Lynn D'Agostino in 5 says, morning, boys. It's the bird and albatross. Heather in Aberdeen says, Gannet. Mary Frame and Willie from Brechin both got the answer right. Can't tell you what it is yet. Hugh in Orkney says, could it be a heron? Martin in Forfar also thinks the Mr. Bird's an albatross. Oot in Dunbar says, attempting the mystery bird, is it a corncrake? I heard one once, only once in Isla, on a magical holiday to celebrate a silver anniversary 9 years ago. Maybe too long ago. Rosie Blagowry says, Mr. Bird, a fulmar. Beautiful bird with a very effective defence, which I'm sure you and Mark know about. Yes, we do. Wonderful show and always a great start to the weekend. Thank you. And on the subject of ragwort, Margaret and Huntley says, forestry weedland beside us. I've battled with ragwort for years. Joe Watson, I think that's probably the late Joe Watson, farming journalist, helped me to get both Scottish Woodlands and Bear Scotland to do something about theirs. Department of Agriculture couldn't get Scottish Woodlands to do much with ragwort, but they were supposedly to do something about creeping thistles this year. But lockdown, and then goes on to say, welcome back, Ewan.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yes, nice to have him back. Back to moths now. And we should say there is a Moth Night event running at the moment. There's a link on our website to find out more if you'd like to take part, which leads us perfectly, back to Dr. Mark Young.
There are some national schemes for running moth traps, so we can see what's happening to the numbers of moths. And there's no doubt at all that in what you might call the more agricultural and industrialised parts of Britain, moth numbers have declined dramatically. Mm-hmm. I'm okay here. I'm in the countryside in Aberdeenshire, and the numbers are not too different from what they used to be. But all over Britain, we know numbers of moths are declining, not just moths, but other things as well. They're telling us that the environment is changing, that there's less space, less semi-natural space for the sort of things that moths do. We have lost some species in Britain altogether, but looked at the other way around in terms of climate change, some species are spreading north. For example, that moth I showed you a little bit earlier, the mother of pearl, it feeds on nettles as a caterpillar. Well, nettles grow everywhere, so it wasn't limited by that. 20 years ago, I got none at all here. I now get lots of them. It's been spreading north, and I think it's probably the climate that's allowed it to do that.
We both live in not just an agricultural area, but an arable area, and farmers, for perfectly good reasons, spray their crops with pesticides. Does it affect the moths?
Yeah, yes, it does. And I'm not saying that things are perfect in this area. I suppose I'm really saying that we have less impact on the environment up here than in some of the more industrial agricultural areas further south. But you may say I'm in an agricultural area, but if you look out here, when I first came here, nearly 40 years ago, I planted a large number of trees. I've got about 4 acres. I've got lots of trees. I've got a wildflower meadow. And many of these moths are taking advantage of the local environment which I have provided for them. So you can do things to encourage moths and butterflies. You know, that's a thing that everyone can do. Here's one, look here, called Nymphula nymphaeata, and its caterpillars live on water plants. So that's come from somewhere near here where pondweeds is found. I don't know how far that is, probably Meldrum House grounds, maybe a mile or so. And that's flown its way here, looking presumably for another pond, trying to spread itself around. Here's another one, look. This little thing here is called the small ermine moth. This is Wyponomuta evonimella.
I can understand why. It's a, basically, it's a sort of, it's almost a silvery lilac colour. It's a beautiful thing.
It is a lovely little thing. But that's the one that defoliates bird cherries trees. So that is a pest species, in, if you like, bird cherry trees. And although it lives a little bit on my trees here, I have got some bird cherries, it's a species which strays all over the place, and you find it even in cities and areas where there's no bird cherry. So some moths do that. Others tend to stay nearer to home. And we'll turn over and see what's on the inside. It's like Christmas, isn't it? You turn over a batch of... There's two more of these mother of pearls.
Okay, right.
But look at these things all wandering around, these large yellow underwings. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
I would say on that, just on that half egg tree, there must be about 30 or 40 moths.
I think you're right.
Why moths? Why are you so fascinated by moths?
Oh, I don't know. I've been interested in moths since I was a teenager, I think. I think I started with butterflies, and I started with, all natural history, but I rapidly realised there were an awful lot of very attractive moths, and so somehow they caught my attention, and I've been with them ever since. Now, if you want to take a picture of a pretty moth, here's one.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is beautiful. What is that?
That's called the pink barred sallow. And isn't that gorgeous? It's the first one I've seen this season, because one of the things about moths is they have their own particular seasons. Uh-huh. And the large yellow underwings are in maximum season at the moment. This one, the pink-barred sallow, is, I would say, a late summer, early autumn species, and that's the first one I've seen this year. It's absolutely beautiful. Okay, so you can see what I'm doing is taking out these egg trays, looking what's on them and writing down the names of the species I'm finding, and then I'm just putting them aside. I'm going to put them all back into the trap, and leave them in the trap out of the sun until this evening. When the birds have gone to bed, and you can hear that robin nearby, I'll wait until it's gone to bed, and then I'll let the moths go so that the birds won't eat them all, because it's rather a feast, isn't it? You can imagine all these moths here.
They don't have a go at each other.
The moths don't have a go at each other, no. Moths are purely vegetarian, in Britain at least, as caterpillars. As adults, they feed purely on nectar. Some of them don't even do that, but most of them do. So they're completely uninterested in disturbing one another. Now, here's a tiny, tiny little moth. You can see here.
Just?
Yes, just. It's got a sort of grey-brown wing with a little diamond shapes along the back. That's called the diamond back, although it's a micro, Plutella xylostella. Now, that is a migrant, because what happens is in the spring and early summertime, large numbers of these fly from the continent to Britain. And I saw them in May in here in very large numbers. One day on the coast in Aberdeenshire, I saw thousands of them. And what they do is they migrate here, if migration is the right word for it. They stray here. They mate, they lay eggs, and this is one of the offspring from those eggs. They feed on cabbages, so that's probably come from my cabbages across there. So can you imagine many moths migrate? And that particular tiny moth comes all the way from France and other areas of the continent. An extraordinary thing.
Does it, when you say it migrates, does it know where it's going, or has the wind just caught it and carried it?
It's a mixture. Many of them in a particular generation are ready to move, to fly. So rather than settling and mating, they disperse. Now, what they then do is they tend to disperse when the weather conditions are right. And although they are flying, they're probably flying with the wind from the south. So you can see that they are making the best of the conditions and are moving north. Then there is the question, how many of them make it back again in the autumn, or how many are lost to our winters? And the answer is we don't really know, although there is evidence that moths do fly south again in the autumn as well. So some will be going back.
Dr. Mark Young, the fascinating stuff. Did you know that moths migrate?
Yeah, I did, actually. It's one of the few things I did know. Because one of the first, in fact, the first outside broadcast I ever did with the BBC was with a young entomologist called Nick Baker down in Dartmoor. Okay. And we did live chat about moths with an outside broadcast unit the size of five big trucks. Yeah. It was just incredible. And off the back of that, Nick Baker said, "Oh, that's a good job," and went and banged on the door of the Natural History Unit and said, "Give us a job," and went on to great things.
Exactly. I mentioned Moth Night, which is ongoing at the moment. There's details online. Ian Bruce also got in touch with us through the week, and he said, "Good day, folks. Out with the family today in Fife, we spotted this butterfly, which seems to have been photoshopped in this picture. Just wondered if this is a common type in Scotland, as we've never seen one like it before." Now, we will pop that photo up on Facebook. Well, frankly, it's probably a peacock butterfly. And although common in England and Wales, it's a bit rarer up here, but open to other interpretations.
Well, we've got quite a lot, Mark.
Yeah, well, I would say so.
I've seen quite a lot in my garden, and I was in a garden in Turriff last week.
No, those are peacocks. That's a different thing. Peacocks, peacock's the bird. We're talking about the butterfly.
No, that's not. The Budleia was covered in peacock butterflies.
Yeah. Oh, well, fair enough. I've got a photograph of it. I must try to get it up on Facebook too, actually. We went to Crathis Castle the other day. The gardens are magnificent. Absolutely magnificent. Beautiful. Walking around there was just an absolute delight. But again, covered in butterflies. But I'm fairly certain those were Red Admirals. With some restrictions being eased earlier this week, walking groups are once again permitted to meet and head for the outdoors together, albeit in groups of 30 or less, and with obviously some safety measures in place. Joining us now is Cash Butt, co-founder of Glasgow-based Boots and Beards. You're getting ready for a walk tomorrow, Cash.
That is correct. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Where are you heading?
We are going to Davila Forest. Apologies if I pronounced it incorrectly. I think it's towards Stirling, just past Stirling in Fife area on the east coast sort of thing.
The Boots and Beards, fantastic name for a walking group. What's the backstory on that? How did you come up with the name?
It was a family project, just to condense the story. It was a family project that first started out. Cousins and my brother and stuff, we'd all get together and we'd go for a hill walk every second week. After that, when we came back from the hill walk, I would post pictures on Facebook, and other members of the community and other friends would get in touch and go, "That looked amazing. Why did you not tell us about it? We would have loved to have joined you on that particular walk." So from there, we seen there was a, people were interested in this type of activity. Mm-hmm. So we decided, why don't we set up an organisation? And we had a brainstorming session, and someone came up with the name Boots and Beards. I was like, that is perfect for what we do. Let's run with this. And that's where it all came about.
Just explain the significance of Boots and Beards, though. Because, I mean, what is the community we're talking about?
We are talking about any member in the community. As far as anyone who's come out with us and can see from our website, there's the majority of people that come in to our walks are mainly from the Asian background, from the BME community. Mm-hmm. But we are actually open to everyone and anyone, sort of thing. It's a process that's taken its time. You know, we're trying to get in touch with a lot of other parts of the community, sort of thing, other different groups as well. But at the moment, it is a majority of Asian Asian participants.
So what needs to happen to encourage more diverse communities across Scotland to get involved in, you know, groups like yours?
So with the hill walking, mainly, it's, you know, we don't see many Asians participating in this activity, but it's a great way for them to improve their mental and physical health. So we wanted to show the community, look, there is an activity there that is very simple, very easy, and it's very accessible. And maybe, you know, it could help you in your life. So why don't you join us in this group? And hopefully this could help in your endeavours.
Where did your passion for the outdoors come from?
My passion would probably... It was a couple of things. So... Number one, I'm always up for doing new things, sort of thing. So when this hill walking thing came about with my cousin, I was like, yep, let's go and try it. Let's try something new. I've not done this before. And my other thing was, as you know, a lot of people go through maybe a bad experience in their life, and eventually when they come out of it, they go, you know, life's too short. Let's do something different and to improve our lives or something. So I had a bad experience in 2013. So from there, I was like, yep, life's too short. Let's do this as well, sort of thing. So that's where it came about.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, there's quite a few folk do that. Cash, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I hope you enjoy your walk tomorrow.
No way. Thank you very much.
Okay, cheers. Take care. Cash Butt there. Nice to catch up with him at some stage.
Yeah, it'd be nice to go out on the walk, and we really would like to hear from other groups, you know, across all communities in Scotland. If you're doing something, getting out in the countryside, and you're taking people who wouldn't normally think of getting out in the countryside, you get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
The moment we've all been waiting for now, the reveal of the mystery bird. before I get to the correct guesses, this is from Sandy Main in Blairgowrie. This is brilliant. Mark said, think of a Kappa Kaylee size. And Ewan made the hint of saying, think skewer. So I will go for the lesser black-back gull, which makes the characteristic kyak-kyak call. Maybe this was an adult female on a nest. Sandy, you've made the very common mistake of assuming that we're smarter than we actually are. That's way too clever for anything we could have come up with.
No. This is a very simple one. So you doing the correct guesses now?
Yeah, I'll do the correct guesses now. Basically, Karen in Shetland says it's a cormorant. Gary in Penny Cook says the same. John in Canella says the same. So well done to everybody who actually managed to get in contact with us and get it right. Oh, Sue Heard says it's the iconic cormorant too.
Yeah, it's a fascinating bird with stories attached to it from right across the world. Nowhere across the seven seas of the world is there a more distinctive bird than the sea raven. A bird used for sport by the kings of Europe.
used to put food in the mouths of the poor in Asia, and by the gods of the Vikings as foretellers of the future. It's a bird like no other, perched on a rock by the ocean, wings outstretched, drying in the sunshine, the greenish-black iridescence of the feathers, catching the light and tossing it around the bird like a halo in such a fashion that the early Christians likened it to the image of Jesus on the cross. Corvus marinus is a big bird, a bird that can dive up to 45 metres, seeking eels, fish, and even water snakes. It's a bird that was swimming in our seas in the time of the dinosaurs and has had a relationship with mankind, enjoyed like few other wild birds. Corvus marinus, thought to be the marine version of the raven till the 16th century. Corvus the cormorant. In the time of Odin, the cormorant was to the old Nordic people the messenger between the folk of the forest and the humans. They brought warnings to the people from the folk, such as danger is coming. They could also warn fishermen of bad fishing by flying against the boat when the men were on their way out to sea. And some cultures view them very differently. In Scandinavia, a cormorant on a church spire is thought lucky. In the States, well, here's an example. On Sunday, September the 9th, 1860, a cormorant took its position on the steeple of Boston Church, much to the alarm of the superstitious. There it remained till early on Monday morning. It was shot by the caretaker of the church. The fears of the credulous were singularly confirmed when the news arrived of the loss of the paddle ship Lady Elgin at sea with 300 passengers on the very morning when the bird was first seen. And John Milton in Paradise Lost was no fan of the cormorant. He cast it as Satan. Thence up he flew and unto the tree of life, the middle tree and the highest tree, there that grew, sat like a cormorant, yet not true to life. Milton describes Satan flying to the highest tree to look down on Eden like a black angel. And it's probably no coincidence that he chose the cormorant, because while composing Paradise Lost, Milton lived across the road from St James's Park, where King James I had trained cormorants for catching fish. There was even an office of Master of the Cormorants in the royal household. In France, Cardinal Barberini watched a royal fishing day. We saw four simultaneously fishing ravens at a place called Fontainebleau, which all have been sent by the King of England to the King of France as a present, along with the trainers and instructions. These ravens fished for trout in the canals. The ravens had their throats slightly laced up by a leather strap so that they wouldn't swallow the fish they catch. Finally, they were called to the hand, or rather the fist, of the trainers, and they most obediently flocked together and disgorged all the fishes one after one, not even slightly damaged by the pressure of the bill. But it was a sport that didn't catch on. James I axed the post of Master of the Cormorants due to cutbacks and a financial restructuring. Of course, it was all based on the Asian system of ukai, where a ring or a leather thong prevented the bird swallowing, and it returns to the fisherman's raft to have the fish removed to allow it to swallow again. In Shetland, it was well known that cormorants, or the muckle scarf, could be tamed with kindness. And on the west coast of California, the feathers of the bird may well have saved a life. In 1853, a woman wearing a dress made from cormorant feathers was found on San Nicolas Island off the southern coast of California. She had sewn the feather dress together using whale sinews, and the woman had lived alone on the island for 18 years before being rescued. When she was brought back to California, she brought with her green cormorant dress. The dress is reported to have been sent to the Vatican, where it was lost. She was the last of her tribe, spoke a language no one knew, and her song was later captured on wax disc. Only a snippet of the song of the lady with the cormorant dress remains, and sadly, 6 weeks later, she was dead. She died of diphtheria. She had no resistance to the diseases of Victorian America.
That's some fascinating stuff, though. What a shame that that dress got lost.
Why didn't they keep it? But it's an amazing story. And just a really sad ending. And she was actually taken off the island because people wanted to farm it with sheep.
Yeah.
And she was an impediment to them, so they took her off. And, yeah, lots of people tried. They brought in Native Americans from all over the country to talk to her, and nobody could understand her language. So, but it's been a fascinating thing. You know, you go from the sound of the cormorant to the Game of Kings to somebody stuck on an island in the west coast of America. But it's kind of taken off, this bird thing, because a lot of people out there have been sending their own birds songs into us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. So keep that up. We're gonna get some of these sounds, get some of these birds, and we'll do some of the research into it for next week. So yeah, keep them coming.
We've got so many comments through this morning. I'm just going to try and wade through some of them. I mean, some of them, we know now it's, you know, basically it's a cormorant, but Andrew and Kendall thought it was a herring gull. He's on holiday in Galloway and looking forward to a foraging course later today with Galloway Wild Foods. Leslie in Edinburgh says, great to hear you back from your West Coast escape, although she still doesn't forgive you for disappearing when she was up near BBC Banff on holiday, having to cope with a non-gourmet picnic on Colliston Beach. She did like the seals at Newsborough. The walled garden at Gordon Castle was lovely, and long walks on several beaches with Hamish the Cockapoo. Who needs a foreign holiday, she says. Who indeed? Dennis Grattan says, I've dived many parts of Scotland and the West Coast. It's usually the best for great underwater visibility, but St Kilda is quite an exceptional wonderland of colour and crustacea, and well deserves the title as the gem in the crown of Scottish diving. Never had the chance to do it, Dennis, but I would really, really enjoy that. Ian Fintry, with his sound number two, says cormorant. He thought sound number one was a different bird altogether, great crested grebe. Good to hear the boys back again. Great show. On the subject of poisonous well-growing plants, I'm astonished at the amount of the poisonous hemlock around. Many people visiting our great outdoors are oblivious to the dangers posed by these enticing and unusual dangerous poisonous plants at their feet. Where are we? Gwen Blair says, I don't think it's a bird noise at all. Says, I think it's Ewan getting into his hammock on board his boat. Now, that's much noisier than that.
That's not a pleasant noise. It's quite a noisy thing because the cabin in my boat is about 3.5 feet high, so it's quite a job getting up there.
Really? Wow. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
I don't think you wouldn't fit in it.
Well, actually, here's a thing. I actually went and bought another backpacking tent the other day. I'm trying to remember what it's called. It's a one-man lightweight.
It's all very well to buy them.
You've got
to
use it.
It's all very well to buy them. You've got to use it.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about using it. I am thinking about using it. I have an idea, which will come up shortly. But it's a wee thing called a Bobcat, and I haven't even got it out of the bag yet, and I'm already beginning to doubt if I've got the right one, given my size. Because, I went online and had a look at it and thought, you know, I've got bigger jackets than this.
You know, last time we camped, and it was an old 70s bell tent, and your feet were sticking out the bottom.
Remember, I had an old army cot. We thought we couldn't actually get it in the tent. Well, never mind. If it rains during the night, your feet will get wet, but that'll be all. Sadly, that is all we've got time for on this week's programme. But we were talking about Jenny Tuff earlier, who's a remarkable lady. She's the midweek podcast this last week, but coming up, we've got a beautiful one featuring the Scottish musician and poet and just general creator, Corinne Polwart. Fascinating talking to her. If you get the chance, download the Scotland Outdoors podcast. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, as you say, great having the team back together again. Thanks for listening.